Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. With me for the 150th podcast is the same man who's always with me for the 50th podcast because it's got a five in it, right, Ken? It's going to be...
That's exactly right.
The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. It's with Ken Milne, and Ken has been the person who, if you don't like this podcast for some reason, I guess you got to kind of blame him in part because he's the one who really showed me the way to how to do this. But thank you, Ken, for coming on once again.
I only opened the door. You ran through it, but it's always a pleasure to be back. I think of your podcast back to my sort of stuck in the 80s. Totally, dude. It's like totally EM. And I'm talking to every PA, every NP, every clinician that does emergency medicine to listen to your podcast because I think you do a fantastic job.
Well, thank you so much, Ken. So every time you come on, we talk a little bit about something that, well, you know pretty well. And I always like to take the deep dive into a little bit of the statistics, into how do we interpret the evidence and stuff like that. So this time, this is something that you sent to me as part of a bigger group, an email where you showed us an article from Nature called Scientists Rise Up Against Statistical Significance. And this was published fairly recently. This was March 20th, 2019. And after taking a look at it, I thought, hey, like I was trying to figure out what exactly we should do for the 150th podcast, and this just fell perfectly in our laps for this. So can you tell everyone a little bit about the paper?
Sure, yeah. You mentioned that it was published in Nature earlier this year, and what they were really talking about was that statistical non-significance does not prove the null hypothesis. And I'll break that down for you. So we often hear people say at conferences, on podcasts, and in blogs, well, it wasn't statistically significant, or it was statistically significant, or it was statistically non-significant. And there's some nuances in that language, and we've really got to get our heads around it. So I thought this would be a fantastic article to talk about, and I'm going to catch myself more often when I talk about statistical significance, because that word significance, it's not the statistical, it's the significance, comes with a lot of, I don't want to say baggage, because it doesn't necessarily have to be negative, but you know, we hold that word fairly significantly, thinking it's important or something, and it means different things to different people. So we want to be really, really clear when we talk about significance and non-significance when it comes to evaluating the literature. So that's what I was hoping to talk about today based on this article.
Sounds great. Well, let's get into it.
When somebody's making a claim, the burden of proof in science is for them to prove their claim. That burden is on them, right? It's not the burden on those to prove it doesn't exist. So if that burden is not met, if you have a claim that drug A has some good outcome, then you have to demonstrate that. And if that burden is not met, what you do is you revert to the null hypothesis. The null hypothesis meaning there really isn't a difference there. That doesn't mean, though, that you've proven the null hypothesis. This is really important. It only means that you can't reject the null hypothesis. And if you do, like, no, there's always going to be a difference. Absolutely, there's always going to be a difference. If you do a big enough study of two populations and it gets big and big and big and big and big, unless you have clones, and again, even if you have clones, they're going to have different, you know, life experiences. Sometimes it's not the years, it's the miles. Those two things, if large enough, you will find some small statistical difference between those two populations. But we need to do more than that. We need to dig into it further to figure out what is really important. And this idea of, oh, if you get past a magical p-value of something, you can spike the ball, high-five your friends, get it published, and you're done. And that means you've proven something. And it doesn't. Like most things, it's significantly, there I go, it's a lot more complicated, Chip.
So I guess give us a little bit of background about p-values. And what happened? How did this become something that was meant to have a very specific focus and kind of mean one thing, turn into being all about the statistical significance and non-significance incorrectly?
Well, p-values started over 100 years ago. So we've been dealing with this issue and talking about it and debating it back and forth for over 100 years. And the p is, it's about probabilities. And while Fisher, Ronald Fisher, wasn't the first person to suggest p-values and the math behind it, he was the first person in 1925 when he published a book to really popularize the idea. But the idea of a p-value was a sniff test. Yes, I'm making up sound effects for your podcast, Chip.
It
was
well, thank you.
No problem. It was a sniff test to look at the data and go, I wonder if there's something here. I wonder if something is really happening in my data set. Is there something going on? And so it was a sniff test to say, well, that's really interesting. Let's dive into that more and let's consider this data set, not just dichotomously as a yes, no, based on some arbitrary level of 0.05 of you win, you lose. You're a clinician, Chip, and you know that we don't deal in absolutes. We deal with probabilities. Is it more likely or less likely to be effective or harmful for a patient? And of course, when you're talking about statistical significance and when you're going into statistical significance, that never tells you whether this is clinically significant.
Are we getting into poos?
Yeah, we're talking about patient-oriented outcomes instead of disease-oriented outcomes. And I guess, you know, we've got MOOs, and I've talked about this, monitored-oriented outcomes, or MOOs. Well, we could also have SOOs, right? Statistical-oriented outcomes, or a SOOEE, piggy. So we should never conclude that there is, quote, no difference or no association. Just because we stumbled or marginally got past some magical p-value threshold. You know, p-values were never, ever intended to be this way. Again, it was just a peek at the literature. And, you know, it should encourage, if you see something, they go, oh, well, that's interesting, replication. And, you know, besides this worshiping of the p-value, and I'll have to send you some funny cartoons and memes on p-values to include in your post, but you know, beyond that whole idea of getting past a p-value, we have a problem with replication in science, and thrombolytics for acute ischemic stroke would probably be the poster child for that. So I think it's really important that your listeners understand when they're critically appraising a paper, they can't just go, okay, yeah, where's the stat? Okay, yeah, it said non-significant or said statistical, or which side of this 0.05 does it lie on? Because that doesn't tell you the quote-unquote truth.
Okay, Ken, so you led perfectly into this. What is the truth? Is the truth out there?
The truth is out there. Oh, man, I was such a Scully fan. I hope your listeners are old enough to remember the X-Files. Yes, the truth is out there, and I want to believe. I do want to believe. But to believe in something, I need high-quality, clinically relevant information to believe in it. So back in 2016, the American Statistical Association released a statement in the American Statistician, which I'm sure all of your subscribers get that journal. They're probably waiting by their mailbox monthly for this high-impact journal to come in. But they were warning against the misuse of statistical significance and p-values. And then this year, 2019, the same organization published a special edition, and I'll give it to you for a link, that included 40 papers on statistical inferences in the 21st century. And it was like a world beyond p-values of less than 0.05. I would say to p-values and beyond, just so I can reach all your audience. And they were really saying, just don't say statistical significance. P-values, what they should do is guide our care. They're sort of like guidelines. They should guide our care, but they shouldn't dictate our care. It's not, oh, you're on this side of the p-value, thou shalt do this. You're on that side of the p-value, thou shalt not do that. If you're listening, you're a clinician, you know healthcare and medicine is messy. And all we can be sure to do is our best.
Okay, so you actually posed this question on Twitter shortly before we started this. And there were some smart statisticians who kind of popped up and gave their opinions on this as well. So can you kind of sum up some of the points that they also made on the discussion?
Well, I don't have the Twitter feed in front of me, Chip.
Oh, okay.
But I
okay.
I do have a memory of Andrew is his first name, but he's a PhD. I don't want to decredential him. He's a fantastic, smart individual, and he's in the stats Twitterverse. And he responded with six or seven tweets, and maybe you can link those in the show notes. But I went through it, and I And I just agree with the ethos. And it was actually at the end of the article, too, that we're discussing today. And that was the most important thing, is to be humble. There are very few things that really dictate that we should do something or shouldn't do something. It's much more nuanced. It's like an onion. It has layers. And I have an EBM mentor named Dr. Andrew Worster, and he taught me that at the end of the day, you need to consider all of these different factors. You know, you've got the methods that they used. You have the results that they got. So there's a step two. You've got the statistical analysis. That's step three. You're not done then. You need to use your brain and think about it and say, how would I apply this clinically? And that's step four. And then step five would be, okay, now I'm going to talk to the patient because I'm an expert on medicine. I've critically reviewed the literature. I've thought about my clinical experience. But I now have to take this information, irregardless of whatever the p-value is, and think about how big is this effect size, how clinically important it is, how wide were the confidence or narrow were the confidence intervals, and then talk to the patient and say, is this something that really matters to you? Is this a poo? Is this a patient-oriented outcome? Does this outcome with this probability, this likelihood, is that something that is important to you? Do you value that? And how do you want to move forward? And you see how many layers are in there. And I think once you include all of those things in sort of a recipe to put together great clinical care, you end up with something so tasty, good, and something that's so fantastic. You and your patient will feel really, really good with the interaction.
Well, and I would add, and we already talked about this, that this is really a big false dichotomy. The p-value of significance or non-significance, as we've already talked about in that regard. And I noticed some of the other things that they talked about is there's some other options that you could go through. So there are other ways to interpret the numbers, such as Bayes factors, S values, false discovery rate, which I hadn't heard of before this. And then there's second generation p-values. So, I mean, there are other ways for us to help break down the evidence and see a little bit about what that statistical significance means. But I think the big thing for me is about what's the actual like patient-oriented outcomes, for example, and sticking with those types of numbers.
Well, think about it, Chip. You know, you run this study, you create this research protocol, and it's not a perfect world. There are not perfect studies. And you put it all together, and then you throw people in the mix. Patients in the mix. And then you throw biases in there and you go through this grinder of putting out this paper. And going through that grinder, you apply some math. And while math is very precise, people aren't. Healthcare isn't. The people who are evaluating it aren't. And so you get this sort of false sense of security that we got it down to the sixth decimal point. This is not physics. Well, maybe it is a bit like physics. Now I'm just thinking, you know, like we had Newtonian physics where it was all billiard balls and, you know, every action has an equal and opposite reaction, these types of things. I think once you get, and I'm just going to use this as an analogy, once you get down into the really small, nuanced sort of stuff, it's sort of like quantum physics. And I might be misrepresenting quantum physics because I am certainly not a rocket scientist or a quantum physicist. But there's all these things about, you know, like weird things that happen. And I think that in healthcare, weird things can happen. And so you've got to take this population, because that's what you're doing a research study on. There's not an N of one that you go, oh, I'm randomizing this one person in a double-blinded randomized placebo crossover trial with an N of one to see if this drug works. We give it to tens, hundreds, thousands of patients and then try to do all this statistical jiu-jitsu and gymnastics and stuff like that. And it doesn't mean trickery. It means we're trying to get closer to the truth, to try to control for things so we can get down to that individual patient. But then we put this like arbitrary, you know, p-value on it with a confidence interval around an effect size. We still have to interpret that and take it to the bedside and talk English, in our case, to the patient and say, I don't know, what do you think?
So with that, I mean, how are you taking, say you're going through a paper, you're critically appraising it, which I know you do, that's kind of your weekly thing, is you critically appraise a paper. How are you incorporating basically the stats? And what are you looking at? What do you generally care about most when you're looking at the statistics itself?
So the stats are the stats. The results you get are the results you get, and the stats you run are what you run. What I think is really important is then how do you interpret that? How do you put that in clinical context? And so usually what I'm looking for in a paper is something that had rigorous methodology, and that means trying to avoid or minimize as many biases as possible, you know, and that includes the randomization, that includes the allocation, that includes things like blinding. And then I look at what was the effect size? Because if it was a big effect size with a really tight, narrow confidence interval, I'm pretty certain that that is where we're at with the quote-unquote truth. And if that has an important patient-oriented outcome, it's not a disease-oriented outcome, a surrogate marker, a monitor-oriented outcome, a loo, which is a laboratory-oriented outcome. As long as it's a poo, you know, I feel pretty good about that. And so my critical appraisal will reflect that, and I'll talk about how I would incorporate that into my practice and talk to the patient. I'm a lot less sure when I see something that, you know, it's unblinded, it's not adequately randomized, it could even be an observational study, and it has this point estimate that's just marginally over some effect size that they think is important clinically, and it has a wide confidence interval, and that confidence interval could cross the line of, quote, no statistical difference. And so it's a lot wishier-washier. I don't know if that's a term, but it's not as clear to me. And then if it's not a disease, if it's not a patient-oriented outcome, then when I'm talking to the patient and talking about how to clinically apply it, I have to be upfront, honest, and transparent and go, you know, we don't really know. We don't. And you know, and you have to, at some point as a clinician, I think we should all try to get to the point where we're okay with uncertainty. I don't know. That's a really powerful phrase. I don't know. But what I do know is I'm going to do my absolute best for every single patient I have in front of me.
Ken, I love that analogy. I love the way you break that down, because to me, that makes this a lot easier. I feel a lot better walking away from this conversation about what I need to do and how I should be looking at things, which really isn't too different than what I was already doing. But I think I have now a better understanding and respect for p-values than I did before this conversation.
Well, that's great. I'm glad you and hopefully some of your listeners have a better understanding. I'm still working at it. It's a work in progress for me. I'm still thinking about these things, reflecting on it, modifying, updating, reevaluating my position. But the most important thing is to stay humble and remember that you do have an NNT of one. And that one is that one person in front of you that you're trying to help. And every single one of those people that is a patient, but they're also a person, is an opportunity to have a positive impact in their life during their time of need. And so sometimes that might be just bearing witness to their death, and that's okay. And sometimes we won't know what's the right answer, but we have to talk about it, think about it, and share that with our patients. And you wouldn't believe the joy that comes with being like that with patients, talking about uncertainty. It's not like, oh, this doctor doesn't know what he's talking about. He's not certain of anything. It's usually a much more enriching experience because they can see you're struggling, you're thinking, and you care. And that's what they care about, that you care about them.
Anecdotally, I guess my N of one that I can say is that I've noticed the same thing when I've talked and interacted with patients and explained, you know, pros and cons and what does the evidence show and things like that, to be able to have an open and honest discussion as far as this is what we think we know, this is what we are not as certain of what we actually know, and here's where there's no evidence or very little evidence of any real quality to really base our decisions off of. I don't feel like patients take that in a negative sense. They like that honesty. They like the fact of knowing that there are things we know and there are things we don't know, and we'll try our best to do the best thing for that patient in that particular scenario.
Absolutely. And I think as your career continues to get enriched by these experiences, you'll come to that spot where you have lots and lots of book knowledge, lots and lots of critical appraisal skills, and also lots and lots of clinical experience to reflect upon. And that'll only make you a better clinician.
Well, Ken, as we're wrapping up here, do you have any other final thoughts?
You know what my final thought's going to be. My final thought's always to be skeptical of anything you hear, even if you heard it from me.
Well, that's great. I guess since we used your tagline, should I still use mine? I'm not sure.
Absolutely. I love going total EM with you.
Well, Ken, since you said your tagline, I guess it's time to add my tagline. So until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.